This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from a critic of Milwaukee's bid to host the Republican National Convention on why it might not be as good for the city as local leaders are hoping. Now, a new investigation from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel finds that pediatric asthma is not an equal opportunity disease in the city. ER visits and hospitalizations for childhood asthma disproportionately affect Black and low-income families in Milwaukee. An analysis by the Journal Sentinel found that the top seven zip codes with most ER visits for pediatric asthma are all predominantly Black. There are a lot of barriers to getting appropriate care for low-income families, but there are also things that make asthma symptoms worse for low-income kids. For one thing, substandard housing in the city often has a host of asthma triggers, things like mold, dust, and extreme temperatures. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you or your kids have asthma? Have you found it difficult to get regular preventive care? What's standing in the way? Have you had difficulty finding maybe a place to live that doesn't have a lot of asthma triggers yourself? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Talis Shelborn is the author of that report on inequities in childhood asthma. She's an investigative solutions reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with a focus on affordable housing, environment, and equity issues. Talis, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Daniel Jackson is professor of pediatrics and medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also principal investigator of the Childhood Asthma in Urban Settings Network, which looks at why children in urban communities develop more severe asthma and how to improve outcomes. Dr. Jackson, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Talis, let's start with you and your report. You looked at these disparities in the Milwaukee area when it comes to especially untreated asthma. Tell us a little more about what you found.
Yeah, so we found that the zip codes with the most uncontrolled asthma are located in the central city. And we found that they're very disproportionate to the more affluent kind of zip codes around that area. We found that children from communities of color and low-income families are at the highest risk. And one interesting thing about those zip codes is that they're located in very near proximity to highways and high traffic areas. So think about I-43, Capitol Drive, Fond du Lac. And when you couple that with kind of substandard housing conditions and those triggers that you mentioned earlier, it really makes those particular communities more vulnerable to having uncontrolled asthma.
And before we dig into some more of those disparities, Dr. Jackson, what do we mean by uncontrolled asthma?
So uncontrolled asthma really means that we've got children who are having quite a few day-to-day symptoms interfering with their daily activities, whether that be play or exercise. And then importantly, a lot of these children are having severe asthma attacks that could have them end up within urgent cares, emergency departments, or hospitalizations. And all of these have a major impact both on the child and their family.
Talis, you interviewed some parents especially and some people who work and teach who are teachers or work in community groups. Can you share the impact of this uncontrolled asthma on these kids?
Yeah, I mean, it really is all relative. So one of the things about asthma is it tends to affect a lot of children at night when there's generally more relaxed lung function in general. And so those children then have poor sleep. They come to school. Maybe there's triggers at school. So then they're sleep deprived and they're having asthma symptoms. So they can't focus as well. They might be withheld from physical activities. And that has a psychological impact. It also has an impact on their, you know, the other aspects of their physical health. So it really does create a problem, not just for that child, but also for the parent too. If they have to pick them up and take off of work, that might become an issue depending on how frequent it is. It's really a disruptive disease, and we really wanted to take time in this project to try and illustrate that.
And tell us one of the causes you found: substandard housing. A lot of people could only afford so much in a house. It's a tough market now, of course, to find quality housing. What kind of things did you find in houses that in apartments that were contributing to this problem?
So it's really all of the things that you mentioned. The mold is a big one. That's one that can be, it has very different ways. It can be someone who's allergic to mold. Mold itself is a toxin, or it can just be an irritant. There's also dust mites. There's pet dander. There's volatile organic compounds. So you think about maybe a parent thinks they're doing the best thing by their child by cleaning with a lot of bleach, but that actually is an irritant. So there's a lot of different kind of pests is another big one, different triggers and that you find specifically in substandard housing that can harm children. And carpeting is just another one because it tends to hold a lot of those things that we just talked about. So droppings from pest, whether that's mold or dust, because the mold spores can travel. And so if you have a place with carpet, it gets trapped in there. I mean, there's so many different triggers that if you're not aware specifically what triggers your child, you can really be exposing them to a lot of risk for more attacks and symptoms.
Dr. Jackson, Talis focused on Milwaukee. Does that match up with what you hear from urban communities around the country?
Yes, unfortunately, this is a pervasive problem in urban communities all across the country. Children living in urban environments are exposed to a variety of different things that are problematic. Talis also alluded to, living close to highways, so poor air quality and pollution is problematic, in addition to living conditions and then also the variety of limitations in terms of accessing care. And all of these things really come together to lead to, unfortunately, just unacceptable outcomes for children with asthma that are living in urban environments.
We're talking about asthma and health disparities when it comes to causes and treatment of asthma. Lower income communities in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the country, as we're hearing, often Black communities in Milwaukee and elsewhere, more at risk, especially for kids, for uncontrolled asthma. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guests. If you've seen this firsthand before in your life, in your own community, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Jackson, before we get back to the disparities, we're talking about uncontrolled asthma. I guess there's some good news when it comes to asthma that it can be treated. People could live fairly normal lives if they have access to treatment and prevention, right?
Absolutely. Whenever I see patients and families with asthma, I tell them that my goal is for them to live a normal, active life. I don't want their child to not be able to participate in sports or other activities. And we have really excellent medications available that can control symptoms for many children. Children that have more severe asthma, we've been fortunate over the last decade to have some additional medications come on the market, which can be really helpful for children with particular types of asthma and more severe disease. But ultimately, we also want to attack things at the root of the problem and help with disparities through elimination of exposures, reducing exposures and the like, and not just relying on medications.
And Talis, we've been talking about the causes. You also write about a lack of access to the kind of health care that Dr. Jackson was talking about a moment ago. Can you talk about that part of the problem?
Yeah, so the best way to avoid ER visits is by having that regular care from a primary doctor. And once a child is diagnosed, a lot of doctors told me it's important for them to see a specialist. And that specialist can help determine how severe the asthma is by testing lung function. They can identify specific triggers. They can tell you if the child maybe needs a spacer. They can teach proper inhaler technique. They explain the difference between medications, a controller, and a rescue inhaler. So it's really advantageous to be able to access that. But for a lot of reasons, residents who live in lower income neighborhoods tend to have trouble being able to access that. I mean, they tend to not only live in higher rates, areas with higher rates of substandard housing, but they also tend to have more lower wage, kind of zero tolerance jobs, right? And so that means, as one of the school nurses from our story put it, you have to lose pay to get care because maybe you don't have PTO and you may not have the luxury of being able to take off of work for hours to go to a specialist. There's also difficulties with transportation. Especially if that specialist doesn't live near your neighborhood and you have to go a long distance to see them. So there's a lot of barriers to that type of care, which really tends to reduce risk for attacks, higher rates of symptoms, and just generally makes life easier for pediatric asthma patients.
Dr. Jackson, is this a problem you see being tackled in communities around the country when it comes to asthma, trying to make sure people have access to the kind of treatments that you can provide.
Absolutely. And, you know, ultimately, as Talis outlined in her story as well, there are community health workers and others that can really serve as important liaisons between the healthcare community and patients and families. The challenge is that we have limited resources for those programs, and we need more of them. They've clearly been shown to be beneficial. We also have had a lot of efforts through our professional organizations to liaison with the schools. So when kids are in school, it's an opportunity to really improve their health outcomes as well. You know, they spend a lot of their week in the school. There are nurses within the school that can be really helpful and can help facilitate, you know, the delivery of these important medications, the controller medications Talis talked about, to try and improve outcomes for our children.
Dr. Daniel Jackson is with us, professor of pediatrics and medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and Talis Sherborne, investigative solutions reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who just wrote a big series on asthma and kids in the Milwaukee area, looking at why childhood asthma disproportionately affects kids in low-income neighborhoods. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests? What do you think should be done to address some of these causes, including housing that could put tenants at risk for health issues, including asthma? Has this been a problem in your own life, in your own family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about racial and socioeconomic disparities when it comes to childhood asthma, especially untreated childhood asthma. Our guests are Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative solutions reporter Talis Sherborne and UW-Madison pediatrics and medicine professor Dr. Daniel Jackson. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guests, maybe your own experiences with asthma yourself or in your family. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bob joins us now on the phone from Kenosha. Bob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Bob?
Well, I was interested in knowing if they'd studied the diet and nutrition aspect and if that affected. Because I got asthma at a later age, in my mid-50s, and I ended up clearing that up with like a primarily plant-based diet. So I didn't know, you know, if that had been studied at all.
Bob, thanks for the call. Dr. Jackson, do we know about nutritional causes or solutions for asthma?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there is a strong association between obesity and the development of asthma that can happen in children and in adults as well. And there are certain types of asthma in adults that are associated with what we call metabolic syndrome or systemic inflammation. So in those kinds of cases, weight loss, improved diet has been shown to be beneficial. So for certain patients, definitely something that can contribute to disease.
Bob, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Tell us, a few minutes ago, Dr. Jackson was talking about ways to help connect people with asthma or who have kids with asthma with health services. You write about that some in your piece. There are some people, I guess, navigators in a way, trying to help people get the help they need. What kind of things did you see in Milwaukee?
Yeah, so I'm really, really glad Dr. Jackson mentioned that, because part three of the project is coming out and it focuses kind of exclusively on solutions, and community health workers are a big piece of that. We found in speaking to people who are engaged in that work that these community health workers can act as literal translators sometimes in some communities, or they can just help translate medical lingo to families to understand what it is they need to do to protect their child and make sure that they're not suffering asthma symptoms. Another thing, yeah, we did find that there were community navigators who can help kind of put together the housing component with the health component. So maybe that's providing, you know, vinegar-based cleaning solutions or special vacuums that, you know, don't make the problem worse, as well as providing other types of home cleaning education to these families. But in some cases, it is a bit tricky because there's only so much you can do about your home environment, especially if you don't own it. But they do work with families to try and reduce as many of those triggers as they can.
Dr. Jackson, you mentioned getting at the root causes, all the things we've been talking about. Do we Americans operate that way very well? It seems like we'd like to, you know, look at the disease and have a cure. Do we have effective ways of approaching problems that you know, include things like housing and neighborhood affordability and things like that?
So there's been a lot of work over the course of the last several decades to help try and address this problem. The NIH actually has funded both the Inner City Asthma Consortium and now the Childhood Asthma and Urban Settings Network to try and improve outcomes for children. And ultimately, things like comprehensive reduction of exposures like cockroaches, environmental tobacco smoke, sources of NO2 in the environment, and things like that have actually been shown to work quite well to reduce symptom burden and prevent asthma attacks. The problem is they've been very difficult to pay for and have them be used on a wide scale. So I agree with you that unfortunately a lot of times our system is based on treating things after the fact rather than preventing them in the first place.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Jackson from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and Talis Shelborn, investigative solutions reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at asthma among kids, often untreated, especially in low-income neighborhoods, Black neighborhoods in Milwaukee. Talis, let's put a face on this, if you will. You follow the story of Angel Harris, her kid with asthma, her experiences with substandard housing. Can you tell us a little bit about their struggle with this?
Yeah, so this was kind of an unfortunate but commonplace situation where a tenant moves into a building. Maybe they have pre-existing asthma, as Angel did, but they encounter a lot of these environmental triggers that we've talked about that really exacerbate that asthma. I know that she had to go to the hospital multiple times and get stronger medications and was using them more frequently because of the conditions of that home. And Angel's case, too, really revealed kind of a big loophole that we have in our code enforcement, which I found is apparently common among a lot of cities' building codes, which is that the landlord is not required to address mold itself. So they can be ordered to address the cause of mold if it's like a leaking pipe or something like that. But there's no specific statute addressing mold growth. And when I asked the Department of Neighborhood Services, they explained that they don't issue orders for mold, they don't test for mold, they really don't have anything to do with it. And that really becomes a problem when rent abatement and withholding programs are tied directly to unfulfilled code enforcement orders, because then, you know, there's really no way to really address that problem. So that was one of the really kind of surprising things that we found in working on that story with Angel, but also one of the loopholes that maybe if addressed could help reduce some of the instances of triggers for these families.
Dr. Jackson, I wanted to talk to you about some research you've been working on a monoclonal antibody treatment, working with uncontrolled asthma. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Yeah, absolutely. We did this work through our Inner City Asthma Consortium and now CAUSE Network to look at children that had a specific type of inflammation or a specific type of asthma called eosinophilic asthma, and who had experienced many asthma attacks in the past, to see if targeting that specific type of inflammation with the monoclonal antibody called mepolizumab could reduce their risk of severe asthma attacks. And it did reduce the risk of asthma attacks by about 27%. But what we found as well was that even the children that were treated with basically standard of care and access to specialists had a great reduction in their asthma attack rate, even if they didn't get that mepolizumab antibody. So, you know, ultimately what we found was that there's a lot of important aspects to asthma care that can impact outcomes. And the big thing that we're doing moving forward for the individual patient that we see in front of us is trying to understand the characteristics of their asthma as best that we can in order to target our therapies the best we can to prevent disease. So it's different, different approaches to this very important problem. There's addressing the root causes, and then there's also addressing, children that are experiencing a lot of severe asthma attacks, and unfortunately are at risk for really poor long-term outcomes and even death from asthma.
And Talis, you mentioned your next part of the story will focus on solutions in the Milwaukee area. Big picture, do you get a sense, having talked to so many people about this, there's a sense of urgency to deal with this asthma problem in these low-income communities?
Yeah, there is. And one of the things that we found initially is that Wisconsin was undergoing some expansions to its current asthma program to include things like home remediation. And so we have a separate piece about that that's coming out as well. But what we found is that what really helps families is education around triggers, kind of having access to that home remediation component, having the support of community health workers, and policy changes to housing enforcement and how we fund some of those medical components. As Dr. Jackson was saying, I mean, there's definitely some changes in the Wisconsin system where they're hoping to shift to kind of more of a Medicaid reimbursement kind of structure that's going to help increase the level of funding that they're able to access, and discussions around how community health workers are paid, as well as some of those policy discussions around how we enforce our building codes and enforce code violations with landlords especially. So those are some of the solutions that we found, things that worked in other areas. And there's also going to be a particular examination into the Greensboro, North Carolina neighborhood called Cottage Grove, where I visited, where there was kind of a really grassroots resident-led coalition that helped address a particular apartment complex that was really, really proven to be an asthma hazard for that community.
We'll watch for that reporting. Thanks to both of our guests today, Talis Shelborn, investigative solutions reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Dr. Daniel Jackson, professor of pediatrics and medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. They joined us today for a look at disparities in childhood asthma. Now, Milwaukee is getting ready to host the Republican National Convention in 2024. City leaders like Mayor Cavalier Johnson, who we talked to on Central Time on Monday, say the event will have a positive economic impact for Milwaukee and could help it gain more political favor from state Republicans. Our next guest questions those benefits. Philip Rocco is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Let's start with the economic side of things. Predictions of big bucks from supporters of bringing the convention into Milwaukee in 2024. You're not as wowed by the numbers you're seeing.
Well, yeah, and I think this is pretty common for cities that, want to host, where there's desire to host a political convention, to project some, huge number, something like $200 million of economic impact. Now, while there's obviously going to be economic impact, like there would be from any, event that the city brings in, I think for me, in looking at the research on this, it's really a question of scale. So, if you think about where most of the economic impact for conventions comes from, it comes from hotel room nights. Usually prices for hotel rooms go up. And so that's where you see, typically that comes out to be about, for a standard political convention, about $20 million. And then the question is, where does the rest of that, $180 million projection kind of come from? And I think it's kind of interesting. I think the city and the Visit Milwaukee has sort of backed off that $200 million number a little bit in since the decision was made. But if you look at those projections, it's really hard to see where that additional $180 million comes from. And if you look at something like where the other spending happens, it's like food and beverages. And that usually is south of about $1 million in a lot of these conventions. A lot of it is insurance. So it really, in terms of scale, not as significant as the city initially projected. Does that mean that local businesses aren't going to see any benefit? No. But it's just in terms of the outsized kind of scale of these projections, it's worth being, I think, a little bit cautious about how much returns we're sort of seeing.
And before we move on from the economic side of things, Mayor Johnson also said, hey, this is a billboard for the city of Milwaukee. If we can show the world we can handle a convention of this size, it's going to put us on the map for conventions of a lot of different and events of a lot of different sizes. It'll pay off down the road.
Yeah. And I, you know, that's sort of hard to sort of test the reliability of a statement like that. I mean, you know, could it be true? Certainly. Is it easy to quantify what's happened to cities that have hosted political conventions in the past? What the net effect of that has been? You know, it's pretty hard. You know, certainly there's a possibility, but it also seems like Milwaukee, I guess one could say, has been bringing in larger and larger events over recent years. So one question is, you know, what is the net effect of that, holding that convention relative to some of the costs, including security costs, I might add, especially given the sort of rise in political violence since 2020. I mean, that's a non-insubstantial cost.
Let's move from economics now to politics. Mayor Johnson told us on Monday that he thinks hosting the RNC could help the city, very Democratic-leaning city, be more favorable among Republicans in the state legislature. Here's a listen.
You know, the benefit of having the RNC here for any Republican, doesn't matter at what level, is, look, you can't say that, you know, Milwaukee is, you know, a bad place or, you know, or any of those lines that we've heard before if we're willing to have and you'll take part in, you know, the Republican National Convention here in our city. And we've heard so many Republicans say this, is that this is a great city, and I totally concur. Now let's act like it, and let's make the investments in this city so we can be a benefit not just to the folks here and the businesses here, but to the rest of the state of Wisconsin as well. That's what I want to see.
So a Republican convention as Democratic or as a diplomatic outreach to the Republicans in the legislature, Phil?
Yeah, if I were to guess what the real motivation behind Mayor Johnson's, I think, real commitment to bring the RNC here, it would be that, right? It's not the economic benefits in the end overall are going to be negligible. And more importantly, because of the state revenue structure, the city is not going to be able to see any returns as a city through the sales tax or through fees on hotel rooms and things like that. All of that money is going to go to the state, where Republicans are going to ultimately have a huge hand in deciding how it's spent. So it has to be the case, just from an analytical perspective, that the motivation for this comes from trying to bring some greater bargaining power for the city with respect to the state legislature, especially on something like the city being able to raise revenues. It sort of becomes like a poster child for why the city should be able to collect revenues off of that. Now, whether or not that's going to happen as a result of the convention, you know, I would count myself as a skeptic, and at the very least, someone who believes that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And if you look at the number of times that cities, not just Milwaukee, but cities around the state have tried to get a better deal in terms of the revenues that they have access to, trying to end some patterns of state-level preemption of local laws, the Republican state legislature has been pretty not receptive to that. And even in comparison to state legislatures around the country, there's a lot of preemption and a lot of constraints on local revenue. And so one question I sort of have, and one thing I'm going to keep looking at here is, you know, what exactly is changing as a result of hosting the convention, right? What, you know, typically in a bargaining scenario, you have to have something to withhold or to deny. And I think the fact that the city was essentially willing to host the convention without any quid pro quo, at least that was visible in the public negotiations, you know, doesn't necessarily reveal the city in a very strong bargaining position. It actually looks like, to me, the city's in a fairly weak bargaining position. And so one thing I'm going to be looking for is exactly what is changing in terms of the level of commitment from state level officials with respect to giving Milwaukee its fair share of revenues.
And just very briefly, as we wrap up, Phil, is there one condition you'd like to see attached to this, assuming that this is a done deal, it happens in 2024, that would make it, at least as you see it, less bad?
Well, I think just from a fiscal standpoint, there was a framework agreement the city signed on to that could be amended. There's a provision that allows parties to agree on an amendment. And I think it would be interesting to see whether or not the state would be amenable to that. If you look at what happened in Tennessee, the state was actually willing to make an offer of a huge tourism grant to the city of Nashville as a way of enticing it to host the convention. And I think there might be some possibility of the city trying to extract a little bit more in terms of the returns, especially given that it's really stands alone among other cities that have hosted conventions in the sense that it will not, the city as a city will not be able to collect revenue off the back of undertaking what I think is a fairly significant logistical challenge and an operational risk on the days of the convention itself.
Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Great to be with you, Rob.
That's Philip Rocco, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us today looking at the impact of the Republican National Convention coming to Milwaukee in 2 years. We heard Monday from Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum on the origin of one of Wisconsin's favorite words.
Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to cut into your regularly scheduled public radio programming, but we're here today to tell you a bit about the beloved word ope and its possible connection to the Midwest. The popularity of the word prompted a Wisconsin listener to wonder where it comes from. WPR's Andrea Anderson has more.
Diane Flaff of Hartford grew up in Wisconsin hearing and saying the word ope. It was about a year ago when someone sent her a video by comedian Charlie Behrens embracing the word and its role in the Midwest dialect.
Okay, ope is a polite apologetic Ope is a polite apologetic exclamation expressing a sincere remorse for using oxygen on planet Earth.
Flaff had several questions about the word, so she reached out to Wisconsin Public Radio's Wisconsin for answers.
I want to know where it came from. Why do we say it all the time? And why did it all of a sudden become more popular, more well-known recently?
Flaff even did an experiment to see if people found the word to be a distraction during a conversation.
No one bats an eye. So I've tried to do it intentionally a couple of times just to see if I would get a chuckle or a look or anything. But there's nothing. Everyone just accepts it as part of our language.
To get answers to her questions, I reached out to one of public radio's favorite linguistic experts, Grant Barrett, co-host of Away With Words. And Barrett had some shocking news to share. The word ope is not specific to the Midwest. We don't own this word.
I'm sorry to take away this Midwestern thing, but you can still have the ranch dressing. We'll still give you that.
Barrett says the word is used across the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and maybe even non-English-speaking countries. So if it's that widespread, where does ope come from?
It's a physical function of the body and not a linguistic function. So what's happening is it's a little noise that you make when you suddenly stop expelling air. So it's a gentle stop. For example, you might be moving or making some kind of gesture with your hands or talking, and then you're interrupted. And you bring your expulsion, your exhalation of air to a sudden end, and it brings your lips together, which creates what linguists call an excrescent P.
Barrett explains excrescent in linguistics means a sound that occurs in a word without having any etymological basis. That P sound can't be traced to a French root or Latin root or Greek root. It's created by our mouths stopping air.
In the same way that the action that we're doing is cut off, the air is cut off too. And it sounds a little like oop or up.
So let's dive into another question. Is ope being used more today? Not really. Barrett says it has been used for at least 10 years and likely much longer. Some people may be seeing ope pop up more in social media thanks to memes. Barrett says they may be experiencing what's called the recency illusion. And that is when, once we notice something, we notice it more. Now, as a Midwesterner, you may be thinking, well, this is part of our identity. It's part of how we talk. And don't you know this matches our accent? There's a reason you think that.
I'm going to throw one more linguistic thing at you, and this is called a markedness. The tendency for a group of people to note that something is typical of them or people like them. And so that's what's happening with OPE here in Wisconsin and places like Wisconsin.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the word OPE. And this story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Georgia, Texas, and Arizona are the top three states in 2020 for contributing guns used in crimes committed in other states. That's according to data from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Our next guests analyzed this data, looked at the wider trends, and followed a murder weapon that traveled over 1,000 miles before its use in a fatal crime. Zusha Ellenson is a U.S. News reporter for The Wall Street Journal who focuses on crime and guns. Zusha, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor.
And Dan Frost is an enterprise reporter for The Journal who writes often about crime in the U.S., also a graduate of Beloit College. Dan, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be here.
Dan, what kind of trends did you pick up on this interstate crime gun trafficking?
Well, when we looked at the data, we realized that there had been a surge in guns moving from states with lax gun laws into states with tight gun laws. And while this trend had been going on for some time, it had really sort of accelerated over the last few years, particularly during the first year of the pandemic. And we found that a lot of these guns, were being found at violent crime scenes. And in particular, we zeroed in on a case where a gun had been purchased in Alabama, trafficked up to Boston, and used in the homicide of a teenage girl.
And Zusha, that story really illustrates how this trafficking works. Can you take us through the chain from that purchase of the firearm by a straw buyer, and you can tell us what that means, and then how it goes on the road?
Yeah, so let's start with the very beginning with the gun purchase. What's really interesting about these trafficking networks is that it all begins with very low stakes and very little money. So a person without a criminal record doing a favor for a friend for a little bit of money goes into a store, legally purchases a gun, and then hands it off to a trafficker who brings it up through the states and ultimately sells it to some gang member or so forth. But the straw purchaser is really interesting, right? This person just goes into a store and buys a gun. In many cases, they're not even thinking where it's going to end up. And in many cases, when they get caught, they get very little punishment too. So the stakes are very low at the beginning of this trafficking network.
And then, Dan, how do the guns flow from the less gun control states to the more gun control states?
Well, the traffickers will typically transport the guns either by rental car, their own car, sometimes even by Greyhound bus. And then once they get to the destination city, which is often a place where they have some sort of connection, they will either set up shop, sometimes in somebody's house or apartment, or they will link up with somebody they know and unload the guns for sometimes double or triple the price that the initial straw purchaser bought the weapon for.
And Zusha, take us to Boston and the end of the trip for that gun. What happened when it arrived in Boston?
Right. So like we said, it started with a straw purchaser. This was a factory worker in Alabama who bought the gun. The gun was then brought up by either car or Greyhound bus. They don't quite know. It ends up in the streets of Boston and in the hands of a young man who carries the gun around with him on the streets of Boston. And then one day, according to his version of events, he thinks he's being followed and he shoots this young woman in broad daylight. It was a horrific tragedy. I mean, this was a very well-loved young woman. She was a basketball standout. She was beloved by many friends, and it really shocked the city. The mayor, the police commissioner, everyone showed up that day, and it really resounded. But few people knew where the gun had originated, and that's what our story really tells.
Dan, can you talk about the difficulty of enforcing either on the straw buyer, on the transport, the trafficking of the weapons?
There are a couple of things at play here that make these particular crimes really difficult to stop. Number one, when somebody goes in and buys a gun for somebody else, it's really hard to prove that they did anything illegal. You're not supposed to, or I should say, it's against the law to lie about who you're purchasing a gun for. But as you can imagine, trying to prosecute somebody for lying on a federal form can be challenging. Number two, when you have states with relaxed gun laws, where pretty much anybody can go in and into a gun store and buy a firearm, that creates, you know, an initial set of challenges for law enforcement. And then once those guns are trafficked up, in this case, up the Eastern Seaboard and into a city like Boston, they really disappear onto the streets. And so law enforcement, already several steps behind, will usually not find these weapons until they show up at a violent crime scene. And it's only then that they will run traces on these guns and discover, tragically, that they started off oftentimes with a legal purchase in a state like Alabama or Texas or Arizona, made by a straw purchaser.
And Zusha, in states that are recipients of these guns, and that includes our neighbors in Illinois, do we have a sense of how much a gun crime is connected to guns that traveled this path?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to look at the numbers, and you see in states like Massachusetts, California, and in places like Washington, D.C., the vast majority of crimes are carried out with guns from out of state. And what's really interesting is those percentages have increased in some of the states with the tightest gun laws. And what people theorize is that as states like California and Massachusetts tighten up gun laws and it's harder to buy guns locally, more guns are being trafficked from out of state.
Dan, are there efforts to try to, I don't know, step up enforcement or prevent those straw purchases in the first place?
Yeah, there's several different efforts, some at the federal level, some at the local level. The Biden administration has made gun trafficking a priority and trying to crack down on straw purchasing. Penalties have been enhanced in the newest gun control package that was passed by the Biden administration earlier this year. And then you have local law enforcement task forces, which are really trying to zero in on trafficking routes and trafficking operations to try and disrupt these networks. But as Zusha pointed out, it's really, really difficult to do until a violent crime has already taken place. And I think what was so sort of tragic in the story that we highlighted was that what started off as just this really seemingly innocuous purchase where you had a guy doing a favor to make a couple hundred bucks, not even that much in this case, for some folks that he knew, that weapon, that purchase ends up being used in a homicide months later.
Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And Zusha, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you so much.
Zusha Ellenson and Dan Frosch are reporters at The Wall Street Journal. We talked to them about their work analyzing and reporting on federal data about an uptick in guns being used for crimes. Those guns initially purchased in other states.